The Why Me Project, an exclusive presentation of Faith Strong Today.
Episode number 185, and we're inching closer to Christmas, so if somebody hasn't said it, Merry Christmas.
And a Happy New Year.
Ooh, I like that too.
Just gonna jump early on that one.
Not much appreciated. thank you to everyone as well who's made suggestions as to people that we should have working for 2021, that's a weird one to say, for guests that we're looking forward to, and perhaps you are as well.
Yeah, and it's been so far so exciting. Some good conversations to look forward to.
Speaking of good conversations, we dive into a whole lot of amazing conversations today.
We absolutely do. I heard this man speak a few times, and I had to reach out to him. So I'm so glad that he said yes.
Ethan Nicholas, my friend, how are you?
I am great. How are you doing?
So far, so good. I mean, I'll be honest. I get intimidated every time I talk to somebody who's involved in fitness because, I mean, if you've ever looked at my body, this body has never seen fitness before.
Well, you know, I'm an intimidating dude before that, so I guess you're in the appropriate mindset.
Well, there you go. We like to ask this skill testing question because we never know where it's going to go. Ethan, who are you and where did you come from?
Who am I? Well, I am obviously Ethan Nicholas, 30 years old, fitness trainer, mental health advocate, public speaker, writer here in Edmonton, Alberta, and I came from, well, my mother. That's it. That's the skill testing question answer I get.
All right.
We're on C-. C- is my average. We'll go with that.
Well, let's talk about school. What was life like growing up? Were you one of those C- students, or were you, dabbling in the A's?
I kind of floated between the two. I lived, we'll call it an interesting life. From the time that I was 5 years old until now, school was done well out of fear of repercussions that were, a little over the top compared to most people's. So I hovered between A's and B's as much as I could, except for I like to talk. So every single report card through elementary had social butterfly written somewhere on it.
Yeah. Well, what happened at the age of five that really changed everything for you?
The person that was supposed to be my father decided to start abusing me. And that abuse lasted for a decade. It lasted until I was 15 years old.
And this was your biological father?
Yes, it is.
You're growing up with, and you used it, the life of fear. Was it fear that you were not going to be smart enough, fear that you wouldn't do anything right, or just fear in general?
Fear that I'd get hurt.
Yeah.
Fear knowing that if I acted out in class, I'd come home to a beating. Fear that if I didn't get straight A's, I'd come home to a beating. Fear that physical harm would come to me just for not doing something the way that I was asked to do, even though I was asked to do it in the wrong way in the first place. It was fear. I lived in that state. I didn't know it. I just knew it as life.
What was it, because you said until the age of 15, I mean, if we're fast forwarding through those 10 years of this is what you're dealing with every day, what changed?
I did. I got bigger. I got older. And the weight of the abuse finally broke me. I spent some time in cadets, spent some time on an air base. The military base for a summer camp, got into a couple of arguments with people that required fists. People started to kind of figure out that something was up with me. I got into it with a kid from my home squadron being a racist. We got into a couple of altercations. He threatened to kill me with a knife. He threatened my little brother, and that was my last straw, so I threw him out a window. And a sergeant that was running my corps pulled me aside into one of our soundproof rooms, and literally all she asked me was, are you okay? Nobody should be this angry. Something has to be going on. Are you okay? And apparently that's all I needed. Told her about the abuse. She's obligated to tell the higher-ups. We got the military police involved. We got the Zebra Foundation here in Edmonton involved the police. My brother was removed from the home until Lenny was removed from the home. And yeah, so what changed was I got bigger, and the abuse just weighed too heavy on me until I snapped.
Wow. Did you feel guilty during this phase at all? Because I know sometimes when it's like an actual biological parent, there's almost that element of I'm turning on my family, or by this point you were just over it.
What it was for me was I developed Stockholm Syndrome early on. So I went along to get along to survive. I didn't know I was doing it. But the messed up part about my story is that I went along. I didn't know any different. It started too early for me to know the difference. I literally thought that this was just how life went. Something didn't feel right around, age 8 or 9, but by then I was too involved in it and too afraid of the repercussions to get out, and didn't know that I had to get out of anything. And yeah, so my brain went and turned on Stockholm Syndrome, and away I went. I aided and abetted my abuser. I welcomed them into my room every night. It was looking back on it, it was like living in hell. It's hard for people to understand and hard for people to grasp. So, and that's why I do the work that I do, because until we can understand, until we can grasp, we can't help, we can't empathize, we can't work on supporting people.
This is something that you're dealing with. You said that you had a younger brother. Was he dealing with the same stuff?
To my understanding, like we really don't talk about this between me and him. It's not my story to tell.
Yeah.
To my understanding, there was some abuse that went his way as well. From what I understand, it was the last few years of mine. But yeah, it's not something that we talk about, and it's not really my story to tell.
Mm-hmm. So you're going through all of this. When it comes to school, I mean, living in fear, getting A's and B's, there's also that whole thing about, you know, the schoolyard bully. I mean, are you the one who would pick on kids because you're being picked on, or are you the person who would then stick up for the kids who are being picked on because you could then save maybe them where you couldn't save yourself?
I did both, actually. I started with the first. I started with being the bully. It was less that I was the bully. It was more that I saw opportunities to try to be cool. I tell a story in my book, hopefully that's coming out, hopefully this year, me picking on someone 5 years older than me, 5 grades ahead of me, and having the entire backing of my grade 6 class for it, like very schoolyard bully stuff. I also remember at the same time, maybe 3 or 4 years later, for the first time I really started to act out and rage quit on people when I didn't like something, was beating on a kid for pushing a girl down our little three-step thing outside our school. And so I kind of walked the line of both. And then as the story unfolded at 15, you know, 13, 14, 15, I started to get this kind of protector instinct that I didn't know what to do with it. And that's where the fighting came from, being in cadets. And then I realized that, you know, I was well over 200 pounds at 15 years old.
Wow.
And people used to walk all over me until I put my foot in the ground that day. And that was it. That was it for me. I started being a protector. I started making a name for myself as somebody that was not afraid to use violence to get his way. And so that turned into a bit of a career for me for about 5 or 6 years, dealing with people's problems for them, dealing with their abusive boyfriends, their abusive husbands, just bad people. And I always wrapped it around the morality that I was just hurting bad people.
When it comes to the aggression, though, did you have a relief of some kind, whether it was cadets or football or sports or something, where you could kind of get that out?
No. That's another big thing for me. The aggression didn't come out until the last couple of years of the abuse, so it caught my mom off guard because I was always a sensitive boy. I got walked on and walked all over most of my life. I was never really the aggressive dude. And then when I started to get that anger, I didn't know what to do with it. I could get hit in the face 10 times and stare at you back and just start smiling because that pain was different. I exchanged pain for something. That's just how I developed an understanding of my body. If I could get pain, I could give it back. So here we go. That was how I lived.
We should have got you into UFC fighting, my friend.
They would have thrown me out.
Okay, so at the age of 15, you talk with cadets and you talk with the police and that. What then happens next? Do they show up at your house? Dad gets thrown in jail? Or what kind of transpires?
I actually wasn't home for it. I was part of a six-week camp, so I stayed at the camp. It wasn't until I started getting into more fights that I got kicked out of the camp. Pretty much immediately after Lenny was gone, I started acting out and then was able to get home. My mom had just bought a new apartment for us, so we were in the process of moving. And then it was kind of plain and basic as my mom could make it. She wanted the transition to be as smooth as it could be. We spent time giving our testimonies to the police and to the Zebra Foundation. And then I was in my first year of high school, so dealing with that bit of change on my own with no extra parent figure. So it was, and that was kind of when I went off the deep end. Once the fear at home was gone, I didn't have a reason to be afraid to not do stuff anymore, so I went and did stuff.
I find it interesting, though, that when you were at that camp, there was, you know, your supervisor who didn't discipline you right away. She noticed that there was something that was not right. Did you find that you had a lot of key people at that time, looking back, that even though at the time you still went off the deep end, as you said, we're still there to kind of show some sort of normalcy and care?
There are a few. I've actually wound up shooting a couple videos earlier this year, my appreciation videos for people that really stood out and helped me. And aside from the sergeant, I've done a couple, and I have a couple that I have to shoot people that were part of my youth group that, you know, I was the black sheep of my youth group, and there was one guy, Darren, who always just saw me for me. He saw that I was hurt. He saw that I was broken and just continued to love on me the way he felt called to do so, and really kind of paved the way that there's somebody out there that actually did care. Because, like, you know, you look back and you think, I was 5 years old when this started. I was 5 years old when the most sensitive boy you'll ever meet stopped being sensitive. And nobody cared enough to ask if I was okay. I mean, I was getting in trouble in schools for being too friendly with girls, trying to understand my own sexuality because I was forced into it at 5 years old. I was frustrated with life all the time, and not a single person, my mother included, knew. Nobody knew. Nobody cared. So when people showed up and cared, I mean, usually they got nowhere with me because I didn't know how to accept it. There were certain people that just kept caring and kept loving. And Darren is one that stands out for me really, really importantly. And we're still friends to this day. And I don't know that he knew that the impact he had on my life until I shot the video and thanked him for it.
So Lenny is out of your life. And you're at the age of 15 and you go off the deep end. As you said, what does that entail?
For me, it entailed a lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of not coming home. I ran away a lot, partying all the time. When I said I made the name for me, myself as a protector and the violent guy, I was security for house parties more often than not. I got into a scrap at my first house party and was invited back every weekend after that to wash the house and protect people. So that's what I did. I got paid to be there and got all the free drugs and alcohol I could drown myself in.
During this time, I mean, you'd mentioned that you had met someone instrumental at youth group. Was God or church at all a part of this process as well?
For me, it's weird. This entire time I was still going to youth. Like, I still, when I was home, I'd be going to church. That was the agreement that kind of fell between my mother and I, was that if I was going to act out, I'd at least still go to church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. And that's kind of where I found worship. That's where I found my real, like, I love music my whole life, but when I found my real love and appreciation for what music can do for you inside and outside the church. And so, yeah, like, my faith plays a huge role in the fact that I'm here. My mom's faith, no matter if we see eye to eye on everything that transpired, is the reason I'm still here. Without that woman praying that I would make it through every day, I know I wouldn't still be here. So, yes, God is a very important part of this story.
We talk about your mom's prayer. We talk about Darren. We talk about you going off the deep end. At what point did then the deep end not get so deep and you came to the shallow end and things started to figure itself out a little bit?
2 years ago.
So it's been an ongoing thing now for quite a while then.
Oh, absolutely. Let's see. Where's my chronological order? Yeah. Was violent. Still violent. Still struggle with that. But was engaged to be married when I went to school for personal training. That didn't fall through. Wound up meeting a girl named Avery, who was my partner for the next 5 years. Unfortunately, that relationship ended. But yeah, it was in the relationship with Avery where, you know, suggested therapy, and I'd always been opposed to it. They tried to send me to therapy right out of putting Lenny away, and it was a joke. They just, you know, they get paid to tell you you're broken, and that's it. They don't try to help you. So I turned my nose up at therapy for a long time, and you know, having my daughter Amara, and with my life kind of in chaos, I quit playing football because I had too many concussions, and took that, you know, healthier use of my violence away. And that was a real hard hit for me for quite some time until I fell into Olympic lifting, and that kind of saved my life there. But it was Avery pushing me to get therapy. There was something that needed to be fixed and needed to be healed. And yeah, so they set me up with one of their go-to therapists, and I'm still with Jay. Jay is the one of the biggest pinnacles in my healing and in my story. And I use him for reference all the time. I reference him out with, this guy saved my life, and I trust him with it. And he'll be a part of my life as my therapist until he either runs out of patience or, you know, I don't need him anymore. So the healing really is only about 2 years old, and I've come this far doing it and kind of just answering the call that God put on my life because the healing started.
I want to talk about therapy for a second. I always thought therapy was like, okay, yeah, it's just a place, like you had said, exactly how you had said when it comes to therapy. Now you see it a lot differently, though. What was that light bulb switch? Because there are still people who think that therapy is just mumbo jumbo.
I'm not sure that there was one eureka moment. It was a lot of things. On my side, it was the fear of losing my family and seeing myself become Lenny. Like, unfortunately, no matter how hard I tried, I was the spitting image of him. And that made me sick when Avery and I had Amara. I hated myself for that. So that played a big role in trusting the process. I think that a massive, a monumental part was the faith that I have in God and the faith that Avery has and a few people who knew I was going to try to step into therapy. And really prayed that I would see it through. Because without that, I don't know that I would have had the strength, the courage, or the wherewithal to do so. And then Jay. Jay himself was a very big defining factor in how he approached me, how he handled me every day, how he handled my attempts to get him to tell me that he didn't want to see me anymore. He stayed true to himself, true to God, and true to what he believes would help. And that was kind of the turning point, was seeing that this man, and for me, even listening to a man, was a big deal. Having the space to feel safe enough to at least trust somebody. I don't really trust people very easily, so Jay working his way in there and allowing me to gain that trust, and he did his job, and it just took time and effort from him and patience while he waited for me to catch up.
I love that you talk about, you know, having your daughter, and you start to see the cycle repeat, because I think for a lot of us, we have kids, and suddenly you just go to that default mode where it's important to have the support to, if that wasn't a good experience, to put you onto a different track. For you kind of starting to see that and then starting to be more open to the idea of therapy and reaching out to people, I mean, like Johnny was saying, a lot of people have a hard time making that because sometimes it can feel very humbling. For you, what were some of those things that just really helped to encourage you to continue on?
Once Jay kind of broke through my initial defense system of thinking that it was, you know, all hoo-ha and hoax, you know, like therapy is a process. Once you're in it, you know that it takes time to get places, but little pieces get taken back or changed or benefit you as you walk through. So noticing that I was slower to anger, that I was made very hyper aware of how I felt in moments where I realized I was going to lose control. Like understanding those pieces and then getting it from Avery when she could see it, getting it from my roommates when they could see it, and kind of slowly developing the skills I needed to take steps into actually healing. Right? You can't just go and heal. Every step is some sort of healing step, sure. But when you have to uncover something like Stockholm Syndrome, you need to be ready to uncover that. So I think that I was already always very centered around how it affected my family. Like everybody else, I could give a damn.
Yeah.
I wasn't at the point yet of the work that I did early on in the first 6 months. It was just, how can I be better? I have to be better. I can't keep this going. For me, the biggest one was my family.
How did race play into all of this? Because I know you and I look very similar. Trini Canadian over here, and you're what, Jamaican Canadian?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, growing up in a very predominantly white culture, essentially, did that play a role at all in kind of the bit of the turmoil just growing up?
It was all about bullying. Back when, you know, George Floyd was murdered in May, we put a rally on the 2nd of June, and I got to speak at it. And I spoke about what it's like to be half black. It's just a weird place to be. You get hated from both sides for no reason. It's absolutely fascinating. Like black people are so hurt at their core by anything that involves around white people that even if you're only half white, you're not black enough to be considered black. And then you get the standardized, complete idiotic racism and hatred from white people. There was like walking, and nobody could tell you why. I hated basketball. I was never good at it, but could throw football a mile. So I just, you know, I wasn't the stereotypical black dude. I didn't play. I couldn't dunk. I couldn't do this. I didn't really care for rap music at the time. I was still soft. So, and my mom was white, and she's who I gravitated to. She liked country and soft rock, and that's how I grew up. My entire family that's here is white.
Yeah.
And so I walked the white side of the line most of my life. Now I walk the black and proud side like no other. I couldn't fit in anywhere. It did, looking back. It was so microaggressive. Something like, why do you know the lyrics to a country song?
Yes.
Well, because my mom's white. I listen to the radio with my mom, and music is what makes my heart beat. So I adapt to music very easily. So yeah, I know country songs. Why wouldn't I? It's in my house.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand in that moment how racist they were actually being. And this is coming from both sides, black and white. White people couldn't understand why a black person would know that. And black people couldn't understand why a black person would know that. Like that, those were the lines that were drawn in the sand early on for me. And so I walked every day of my life with some form of microaggression, some form of racism. There was never a day it didn't present itself. Mm-hmm. You literally become numb to it, especially being mixed, because it comes from both sides. There's no safe place for you to go hide. There's no safety net because you're not welcomed by anybody. And so I walked my life, my childhood and adolescence like that.
Been there.
Yeah.
I'm white. I don't know.
Yeah. But it is very interesting to kind of express and to be in a movement and to, you know, talk about making it awkward, talking about how do we love everybody well. For me, my experience is a little different. I felt like I was supposed to be cool because I was mixed. I was supposed to have good rhythm. But like you, my mom is white, and so sometimes the white side comes out, and there's not much rhythm there. And it's a totally different sort of experience, and then people expect you to feel the same way, but you just can't possibly.
And I think like a big part of it is the lack of understanding of the why.
Yeah.
Like why? For me, I was never fast. Like I was a very small, like skinny, scrawny kid. I was never the fastest. And yet I was one of the darkest kids in my school for a very long time. So I thought black people were fast. I don't know why I'm not fast. I am trying. I am literally head back, eyes open, running with my mouth open.
Yeah.
And I can't go any faster. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
And it's crazy how stuff like that is just, you're like, yeah, why can't I? Why don't I have rhythm? I've literally seen my parents do the jig every day, and I can't figure out how to do one disco move. It's fascinating to me how rampant that ignorance is and how ill-prepared we are at those ages to deal with it.
Yeah.
And the people, like teachers, like we've been talking this entire COVID since the rally, that the education of this needs to be so much stronger for the people that have to do the educating. If you don't know, how can you teach? So where are we educating the people who teach? We're not. And so this problem's going to continue to happen. Sorry, I went off on a soapbox preacher moment there. I don't know what. How that happened. You had to mute me. You had to say, stop it. Because I'll do that. If you let me go, I'm going to go.
No, it's funny, like it though, for me.
But what I love, though, is that, I mean, I've known Holly for 20 years. You and I can have this conversation. As a white guy, I never realized any of this was ever a problem. I was taught growing up, you just love everyone. It doesn't matter what they look like, where they're from, whether they're rich, whether they're poor. And so it isn't until you see all of these rallies and that you see, oh, I guess there is an issue. I'm just oblivious to it because nobody's ever told me.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of like the, you know, we use the word ignorance a lot, and it's become this negative, kind of ugly mark that people don't want stamped on their foreheads. For me, I define it as ignorance, which is what it sounds like you had, where you just 100%. Never were told, you didn't know.
Sure.
How were you supposed to? That's an ignorance that we can handle. It's that willful ignorance over to the right that I've been told, but I just don't believe it. There's no way that that's possible. There's this, there's that. See, that's that willful ignorance that we have to destroy, because over here in ignorance, yeah, the lack of information is one thing, but now you have the tools, you know that there's information out there. So it's on you to go do it. If you continue to choose not to go do the work, you now become willfully ignorant, and that's where the actual problem lies,
which is probably even worse.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That is like the thing. When you have the information and you either refuse to go get it or ignore it, you are now willfully ignorant and the major, major contributor to the problem that is already a problem.
Do you see, since the rally in Edmonton, rallies that have been going on throughout North America and the world, have you seen a change? Do you see a change?
I feel that there is tentative respect in the air. There's still a very aggressive gap between understanding and being part of the solution and not. There's a kind of a line in the sand, so to speak, for white people right now. And people are going to hear me say white people and get offended, and that's between you and God. If that offends you, go look in the mirror and figure your stuff out so you can deal with the problems that you have, so you can help us deal with the problems we have in real life over here. Okay, cool. Okay, we're going back. All right. The actual growth is the openness of conversation now.
Yeah.
This, okay, so they've literally yelled at us that there's a problem. Am I going to choose to stay on the outside and just watch and hopefully they don't yell at me? Or do I get close enough to hear the screams and pick up the yelling myself? And that's kind of where we're sitting right now. Is there tons of change coming? I haven't seen a ton of physical, tangible change, but what I have seen is this openness for conversation. I've had conversations with people across North America because of the work that I do and how far reaching it goes. And people are leaning on me as a half black, half white man for insight on what it's like from both sides. Like, that would have happened prior to George Floyd, simply because, and that's where kind of COVID was a weird blessing, and people are going to get mad at me for saying that, but whatever. Without COVID, we couldn't have focused all that energy and attention on George Floyd. The world watched that happen for the first time in our life and had a problem with it because they had the time to have the problem with it. So people being off caused the light to be shone on what happened to George Floyd and caused the light to be shone on every racial injustice that has happened. And this movement kind of just blew up. There is a problem and I need to help. If I want my kids to be in a world that's better, I got to do something now, because clearly my parents, my generation, didn't do it. And that's why we're in this mess.
And that's what I've appreciated a lot, is even my friends coming to me saying, hey, this is what I've been talking to my kids about. What would you think? And I'm totally okay to have those conversations because I'm not exhausted with them. I've never had to have them, you know, a lot. But I think by us being able to, you know, being mixed and be able to shed light in both worlds is kind of a unique position. So for you, what is some of the work that you've been doing these past 2 years?
Real quick, before I get into that, I need to caveat this by saying, what Holly and I are saying doesn't mean go ask your black friends a bunch of questions. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
Okay, you now know that there's a problem. It is on you to find the information. If you want a book, ask me or Holly. If you want a book, ask one of your black friends. But don't go asking the history and the whys and the hows and this, because unlike Holly, I am exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of us are exhausted. So the right path to take is to educate yourselves. If you have questions about the education you have or are getting or are finding, that's something. But do not lean on us to educate you with something we had to learn ourselves.
Yeah.
There's my caveat and my PSA.
No, it's definitely good to say, because I've got a lot of friends who would be in the same camp as you. And for me, I'm still learning. And so it's exciting in some ways for me to really dive in and to explore. And so I'm still happy to share my experience. But I know for sure I have so many friends and family who are like, look, Google it. There's so much out there.
Yeah, and I think
there.
That if I didn't have the fight going every single day in some way, shape, or form, I probably have more space for it.
Yeah.
But this is the work that I have to do every day. So for me, it's like, I'm like, no, look, the information is there. We've posted it a million times. If you can't go back 5 days and look for it, there's a huge problem with how you're attacking this. So call me when you're ready.
Yeah. Effort needs to reach the same level as desire.
Yes. Okay. 2 years. 2 years. Yeah. 2 years. 2 years. 2 years. So the work I do for mental health and advocacy started in therapy. I used to write. I don't say that I'm a writer. I do now because it counts, because I wrote a book and it's fun to say. But I was never. I tried the journaling thing. I never got good at it. I couldn't stay consistent. I had other things going on. But I wrote a piece and didn't really know why I wrote it. I just all of a sudden was sitting down in my basement and my hand started to shake. And so I grabbed a pen and just started writing out a piece of my story. And then as I was writing it, I thought, you know, if somebody reads this and can relate to my story and can keep fighting, if I die tomorrow, that means I will have left a better impression on this world, so I can die happy. Because up until that point, I really was like not a human being you want to be around. I was a very violent, I was very angry. I hated the world for letting that stuff happen to me. And I really wasn't nice. And that dude still comes out. That's why I went to therapy. I didn't plan on living, if I'm being honest. When I put that out, I really wanted to die. I didn't have a set plan, but I knew that week I would kill myself. So if I got this story out and one person saw it and kept fighting, that counts as a win because they're still here. I don't deserve to be here, so they can take up that mantle. I was sitting there, not sure how to share it because I didn't want to rewrite it. And God literally said, and he said, put that on your phone. And so I put it onto Facebook, and before I could talk myself out of it, I hit send and then didn't look at my phone for 6 hours. By the time I got back to my phone, people were thanking me for sharing. People were messaging me saying they couldn't believe that I had that kind of frustration and anger in me and all this stuff. And I realized something in that moment, that there was just a load of hurt in the world that I could understand better than anybody. And it was right then God was like, you don't know it yet, but I'm going to use you to do something. Sitting in therapy the week after, my hand started to shake. I was literally talking to Jay about this experience I had. Hand started to shake. He gave me a pen, and it happened again. I wrote out an entire piece, put it on Facebook. Away it went. And every time I shared a new one, I thought, well, hey, that's just one more good thing I did before I die. That's good. I can deal with that. I started to self-harm again and took a turn for the worse in, was it March of last year. I made an attempt on my life while all this work was going on. It was really kind of the pinnacle where I harmed enough that I lost so much blood. Had to wind up in the hospital. Thankfully, my roommate is a quick stirrer. He came and he took me, and I required 30 stitches. It was a big deal. And really sitting in the hospital and seeing the kindness of the doctors who was even talking to me. He didn't care why I did it. He didn't want to know that. He just wanted to know if I was okay, if I was okay to go home, if I was okay while I was laying there. The nurse wanted to give me a bunch of resources for mental health. And I kind of saw this community there that didn't have to be nice to me. They could have chose the other route where people don't know what to do with self-harm and depression and suicide, but they didn't. They showed a ton of love and empathy. I never called it a suicide attempt until much later in the year, mostly because of the shame that I felt for letting myself get that weak. That's how I saw it. I see it differently now. And then writing kind of evolved into, like, there's got to be more. Like, people are seeing this and it's mattering, but this is going to go somewhere. I feel something else here. And God, I was like, as long as you're at the front of this, I know I'm going the right direction. And then it was, I shot like a 60-second mental health minute video, I think was my first one. I thought, if I put these little tips and tricks, how did I get here? How did I survive? Well, if I put my tools out, then more people will have them. And then, you know, we can start to do this thing together. And so I put out, I think, only 6 of them before I got tired of doing them. And then it turned into me making 5-minute videos about what I went through. And that's where this really started to blow up. And it was, I would say, right around this time last year, I started making those longer videos. When I did, I started getting dudes that were 50 messaging me saying things like, you have to keep going. I cannot believe I didn't know this about you. Yeah, you got to keep going. I'm watching you. If I'm watching you, there's got to be somebody else that needs to hear it. And there was times when, you know, I questioned, am I doing the right thing? Is God really at the center of this? And less than an hour later, I'd be flooded with inbox messages from people I didn't know were listening. People that had just started therapy, people that had given up drinking, people that had taken steps in their healing. And I was like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I'm going to change this world. And so that's where I've been. Cornerstone Counseling picked up my videos. They saw the value in what I was speaking about so much that they literally took my videos from YouTube and then started sharing them. Like, my voice mattered to an entire counseling center so greatly that they literally asked to use my content to help people. Like, that's mind blowing to me. And this is right when COVID's hitting. Like, this is when all of a sudden fear is ramping up. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Left from right, and Cornerstone jumps in. Through COVID, I've met 5 different politicians to talk about, you know, the more political side of mental health, like what is there happening. I've been involved in suicide prevention teams. I'm involved with one now. And it's this COVID break from my business of training has been a blessing for the advocacy work that I get to do and the speaking. I wrote a book in 30 days this summer. Wow. I wrote my literal manuscript on my life in under 30 days. It was literally the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. 2,000 words a day. The last 5 days were about 5,000 words a day. But I did that because I had the ability to do it because of COVID. Literally, that's the last 2 years of my life. Like, I started with one piece and thought, you know, when I die next week, I'll at least have left this world better. And now I'm like, I ask why I'm still here a lot of the times. And God literally, he's like, because you've got work to do. I've got you here for a reason, and you're going to do that work whether you want to be here for it or not. You're going to do it. And I rest in the fact that even on days I don't want to do it, God's got a plan for the work that I do. Somebody needs to hear it. And it turns out it's not just Edmonton that needs to hear it.
Yeah.
I'm going to change this world. If I have to do it by myself, I'm going to change this world.
Well, we cannot wait for the book to eventually come out, because obviously it's going to happen. Love your honesty. You can go to pitythefoolfitness.ca. Ethan, we appreciate you and appreciate you taking some time and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you for having me, guys. It's been a real blessing to be here this morning.
Big thanks again to Ethan for taking some time, for being real. You could tell that there is passion. You could tell that there is anger, but yet you just see such joy and just how incredible this man truly is.
Yeah, life is messy, and I love that he has taken the time to work on mental health and also to be an advocate for it, to help others through the similar situations that actually surprisingly a lot of people do face.
Reminder, if you want to hear of other people on the podcast, maybe you have some suggestions, you want to download, you want to make sure that you listen to us or check us out on places like Instagram or Twitter, on Facebook. You could download on Apple Podcast or Spotify.
And you can always head to faithstrongtoday.com.